This is Beyond Species, a podcast exploring issues around speciesism and the struggle to dismantle it. In this episode, we hear from Joe. Joe uses a systems thinking approach to climate justice, which helps to identify the impact of individual and systems change. Joe picks up on some of the problems with the mainstream environmental movement, calling for it to center social justice and inclusion. Joe shares some thoughts about the situation of climate refugees and the rise of eco-fascism. Joe also explains how imagination and futurism can be harnessed to envision and empower our communities and help create the worlds we want to see. So do you want to start then by just giving us some background about yourself and the activism that you're doing?
Yeah, sure. First of all, thank you so much for having me. I've said this before to you, but yeah, your work really inspires me. So it feels like a great honor to be on your podcast.
Thank you.
So my name is Josephine Becker. My pronouns are she, her. My activism, I suppose, surrounds a lot around like climate justice, climate activism. I kind of like study this field. So I'm doing my master's in sustainability and behavior change at the moment, which focuses on like participatory system change and environmental justice and a bit of futurism. And then outside of that, I look a lot around like climate movements and anti-oppression work, all around, yeah, sustainability beyond the zero waste movement. And yeah, so I kind of focus on that and I use different outlets, through like social media and podcasts and other organizing, and look at like refugee rights as well, and try and like do my unlearning in many different ways. But I would say that's like my main focus. Yeah.
Okay, great, thanks. So I'd like to hear a bit more then about systems thinking and systems change, because I hear this a lot, especially in like the animal rights movement. That's kind of like mainly what I've been involved in, but I guess also like the climate justice movement or any movement for social change. We're often saying, you know, change the system, smash the system. Mm. You know, we need systemic change. Individual change isn't always the way and stuff like that. But do we actually use enough systems thinking? Because obviously that's like a particular area of study, I guess. Mm. So I wonder I'd like to hear more from you then about systems thinking and maybe how activists could use that in their day to day.
Sure. I think for me, I have a background, I think I got into my activism like through all of these individual changes, like through going vegan and then trying to eliminate plastic. And for me, it was almost like the more I learned, the more I also saw that like me as an individual won't be able actually to solve the big issues around our world, because there's so like everything that I am part of is designed to be exploitative and destructive. And like me just trying to opt out of that system doesn't actually work when I'm so interwoven into these systems. And I think it also recognizes that like I personally don't like live a single issue life, and like no one really does. Like we have super complex, you know, like identities and like social networks and just like places, and like being in this world is super complicated. And therefore like not taking a system approach and just focusing on your individual approach, I think is like, it's doing something, but it's not actually tackling the roots of where all of this destructing and like exploitation comes from. So like for me, I think that's like kind of like where my interest in systems thinking came about. And obviously mm-hmm. there's so much theory and there's so many different approaches of like how system change comes about and actually what is a system. But like for me, I guess I see, like for me, it's always been like, you look at the root, what's at the root of the single, of the issue that you want to address. So particularly like climate change, you know, like climate change is an extension of like white supremacy and colonialism and patriarchy and ableism and classism and speciesism. And so without addressing kind of like the underlying roots, we are only covering up the like the issue. And so, you know, there's like, for example, there's one theory that I really like, even though it's got a bit of a technical approach, but it's looking at like the multiple layers within a system, and it's looking at like small scale and it's looking at like the macro scale. But it also says that, like, you know, we are all, it's almost like we, because of our complex identities, we are participating in a range of different systems. So like while I, for example, might have in my value system an anti-capitalist approach, I'm still part of capitalism, because like how can I not be if my entire society is based on capitalism, right? So like I guess a system approach then acknowledges that like I individually, whatever I do individually matters because I'm part of the system, but also me as an individual won't be able to change everything. And that's a good thing, because like I shouldn't have as an individual all of the answers to everything. So like a system change approach kind of takes this approach of like, we all matter, and like the collective action matters more than individual, but for collective action to, you know, be successful, you need all of the individuals. But yeah, I think, I guess also for the vegan and the animal rights movement, particularly, like, you know, it's going beyond like the vegan capitalism, and it's actually going like, actually we need to address also the underlying roots of, you know, who's then making the vegan product, and like, why should capitalism still exist? Because capitalism is based on oppression, whether that's like humans and non-human animals alike.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, that's helpful. Actually, thinking about capitalism there, I find that getting the message across that we should be anti-capitalist in our activism is a difficult one. And I guess it's because, especially in, I don't know what you would call it, but let's call it the Western world for now, or the global North, we're so enveloped in it. And it's that kind of neoliberalism that's come in the last few decades, where the individual is presented as the ultimate. And so we think that to have the most effect, we should become like, you know, a celebrity individual or a famous individual. And that's what the movies tell us as well, right? It's like, you know, become famous, and then you have power and influence. And that's why we get social media influencers. But I feel like capitalism, although it's everywhere, it also feels like it's maybe the most invisible, because we're so wrapped up in it, because it's in like every kind of interaction we have. I've seen it described as like, capitalism is like, it's like if two people have an interaction, there's usually a thing in between them. Like we're interacting around the physical thing. Do you know what I mean? Something like that. It's probably not explained well, but yeah, that's a kind of how I think of it. And so how do you think we can encourage people to question, or maybe a lot of people are questioning capitalism already, but how do we get them to realize that it really is a huge, huge problem? Because in the environmental movement, of course, there's a push for things like the Green New Deal. Renewable technologies will solve everything, geoengineering and stuff. So how do we get out of that capitalist mindset?
Yeah, I mean, it completely resonates with me that you're saying like it's really difficult, like in, even in activist spaces, to talk about this. And I think even for me, like when I first started my activism, I was like, oh my gosh, like that's so radical. Like and like it took like a little, like, you know, like you have to get over this hurdle. And I think many people think that like capitalism is this like natural law that has to exist. And I don't know where it's coming from. I mean, I guess that's for people who profit off capitalism, that's the beauty for them, that like they have made it seem so inevitable that like it's so difficult to question. But I think to when we look, especially in the climate movements, for example, I really have an issue with like the way that we constantly frame everything around money and financial gains as if that's like the only way we as individuals or as a society can thrive, let alone the planet and like other beings. And, you know, obviously there are some incentives around money, like money is a tool and it shouldn't be more than that. And capitalism, especially like how it like makes our identity completely like be intertwined with like, yeah, I think like the inspirations to profit off capitalism are so great. And like you said, like celebrities and politicians and like everything that we watch installs that narrative that like one day you will profit off capitalism. But like, you know, 99% of us don't actually. And I think people are really scared to question it because they don't know alternatives. And what I always get is like, oh, but communism or socialism didn't work. But like, I can still question things without having the one answer. And like, for me, it's also always like, and that's tied again to like systems thinking of like, maybe it's time we deconstruct that there has to be one single solution for the entire society, for the entire planet, for the entire Western world, as we call it. Like, you know, like it's actually really oppressive to say that there should be one thing that fits all. And I think when we like now look at like what, when we're trying to do like activism and we're trying to find like different futures and from trying to find like new solutions, having our monetary value as the primary focus, I think actually reinstalls negative values, you know, like rather than seeing money just as a tool and seeing money as like redistribution of wealth or resources to actually get an equitable, just society. So I think in that way, like capitalism can be quite scary for people to talk about because you question their livelihoods. And it's like for a lot of people, like middle and upper class, especially, like you question, or like they start questioning, oh my gosh, you're going to steal something away from me. And for people who haven't profited off capitalism, I guess it's also a bit of like you're now telling them that they can't have what other people have had. Yeah. And that can also be really difficult. And I think that's why like there has to be a multi way of solutions. Because saying like this can't be and this has to be is again, you know, another way of domination. But we have to be able to question capitalism.
That's a good point you hit on there, actually, where you said that we have to get out of this way of thinking that there's one solution. And I think that's like really one of the biggest keys is that, I mean, I've heard capitalism and modernism, which kind of go hand in hand, actually described as like a great flattening. You know, it's like capitalism just rolls out there, like extracts all these resources and turns everything into moles, you know, like metaphorically in a way. So it's like, and you've heard people, I mean, I always hear people in the UK, right? Anyone who's listening who's not from the UK, if you come here and you go on the high street, you will see the same shops everywhere, no matter what town you're in. And that's what it does. It makes, there's this attempt to make everything the same. And that kind of gives us that comfort. But the reason that everything's the same is because there's like multinational corporations profiting off it all, right? But like society is going to flourish better, surely, if we allow for that creativity and diversity of responses that come from the ground up.
For sure. And like, I think also like as individuals, I mean, if it hasn't been become clear before, like this pandemic, especially, you know, of like the priorities of our countries and our governments, for example, I mean, especially like here in the UK, you know, everything is open that has a till and everything that doesn't have a till is closed, you know, and like, and that's like, doesn't that show us like how little our like individual bodies of as beings and like the planet and everything like matters, and everything is focused on profit. And like, there's no, you know, there's no like healing. There's no, people can slow down. People can actually, like, people were able to express themselves like creatively or whatnot, like for a while, but also the people hustling the most and in the most like low wage jobs and the, like, some of the like least individually profitable jobs, but most profitable for the government, they were kept opening. And we also have to look at like who's working those jobs, because the people in the, like, you know, yeah, the people most profiting off capitalism weren't in the shops and most vulnerable to COVID. And and that's exactly what capitalism does, you know. And I think when we think of alternatives, actually, like you were saying, like society in so many ways would flourish, and like it would, like, and so, and like there would be so many benefits, but for everyone. And that's exactly what capitalism is trying not to do. That it definitely tries not that everyone flourishes.
Yeah, it's that thing about centralizing so that the money flows upwards, right? To like the top of that triangle, and everyone else is at the bottom of that triangle. Capitalism and green capitalism and renewable tech and stuff kind of moves us into thinking about this response by the, by, I guess, some parts of the environmentalist movement. Especially in the UK, we've seen Extinction Rebellion. I know it's gone worldwide, but, you know, it's got a big presence in the UK, and it's drawn a lot of people in that maybe wouldn't have been involved in environmental activism previously. And the goal is to kind of make activism available to everyone so that we get everyone in society involved, which is obviously sounds like a good idea to me. It's like we want engaged citizens, basically. There's obviously been problems with that as well, in terms of some of the critiques of Extinction Rebellion particularly have been things that they aren't anti-capitalist, they're actually pro-capitalist. There's been problems with the way they haven't thought about or kind of accommodated the needs of people from marginalized communities. You know, the thing about kind of glamorizing arrests and saying, let's get arrested. And that's not, that's fine if you're maybe a white person from a certain socioeconomic bracket, but if you're not, then it's probably not a good idea to volunteer yourself for arrest. So what do you think then in terms of maybe the current state of the this kind of mass mainstream environmental movement? Has it become trendy in a way?
I mean, yeah, I definitely, I mean, particularly, you know, like individual things around like recycling and like all of these trendy YouTube crap, that's definitely like a scam in my eyes. Yeah, like green capitalism won't save anything. But I guess as the urgency of climate change becomes more and more apparent and more mainstream, obviously that's a good thing in a sense that we are raising awareness of this super important and devastating like issue we're facing. But unless we have a justice-centered like movement or approach, I think it will just shift like one toxic system to another. It might actually be more toxic in a way. I think it's like it's super important that in the climate movement we need to acknowledge like how like resource exploration and environmental exploitation are inevitably linked to injustices historically and presently. I mean, particularly being in the UK, like the UK is one of the longest industrial histories, and how has that been achieved? By resource and environmental exploitation, like abroad, linked to, you know, colonialism, the British Empire, and, you know, and though, and that still is upheld today, and the values around that still uphold, like are still upheld today. So like, while I think a lot of people are getting into the environment movement around their individual concerns, obviously I wish that was, you know, I wish we wouldn't need the individual concerns and we would just say like, oh, look, like this is beyond myself, I'm going to get involved. But a lot of people are finding their way through their individual concerns. I guess that's like, okay, that's like one way to enter the movement. But then when you're there, then we need to recognize, particularly then, that we're not all affected the way. And like, particularly people like Black, Indigenous, and people of color, and particularly in the global, like so-called global South, are already affected, but also, you know, in the UK or low socioeconomic groups. And it needs to recognize that, like, without placing justice at the heart of sustainability, we are again only treating the symptoms rather than the root causes of the crisis. Mm-hmm. So when I look at, for example, Extinction Rebellion, and having been involved in the past and leaving Extinction Rebellion because of the ways that they aren't like centering justice, I am asking myself, or like, well, someone else posed this question recently and I've been mulling this over and again, why doesn't social inclusion matter to the environmental movement? Because what does that say about who we are trying to achieve sustainability for? Are we, you know, are we wanting sustainability only for white, cis, upper and middle class, you know, like, heterosexual people? Because that's not sustainability. So I think looking at like the collective action, there's already so much work that's being done to address the climate crisis. And something that Kyle White talks a lot about, he is a scholar and he's a member of the Métis Nation in Turtle Island. He speaks a lot around like how Indigenous peoples already live in post-apocalyptic times. And like these times were intended to be there by the settlers. And when I think about that, it's like, well, the settler mindset, or the capitalist mindset that like I've like even that like I've grown up with and I'm trying to unlearn, but like, you know, that will be a lifelong learning journey for me. And like maybe particularly then when we have been installed these values, we need to like we need more spaces for people who have different values and who are already fighting the climate crisis and who are on the ground, like, you know, having survived decades of genocide and ethnocide, and they know, and they can teach and they can lead the way. I don't think that an environmental movement without justice will do anything good.
That's interesting, that thing about it almost makes, it would make perfect sense to make social inclusion, social justice, the heart of the movement, because ultimately that's what it's going to come down to. So it's like as if this mainstream movement is going like around it and kind of avoiding those issues and saying kind of, oh, well, we'll get there in the end. In a way, it reminds me of when vegans say things like, oh, yeah, you know, yeah, the environment's important, human rights are important, but actually, if we all go vegan, we'll solve the environmental problem as well, because that'll like, obviously being vegan's better for the environment. So we don't have to like worry about that right now. Let's just get everyone to focus on going vegan, you know, for the animals, quote unquote. Exactly. And I wonder if there's something going on there. It seems like it is definitely a colonial mindset. It's that whole thing about find the new one way, roll it out, and eventually everyone's going to benefit, but we know from the past that everyone doesn't benefit.
I think it's so interesting because it like justice can't be grafted onto unjust frameworks, and you know, like this way of like, I'm vegan, therefore I can't be racist, or you know, or like like, I think it's like this obsession of being a good person needs to completely be abolished in our hearts and our society. You know, we can do one good thing, and it doesn't mean that we can't be harmful in other ways. And whether we are a climate activist or whether we are a vegan or whatever we are, like whatever kind of like, I guess our main battle is that we are focusing on, we still need to be looking at the other ways that we are privileged and that we are part of oppressive systems, and we need to be actively tackling those. Otherwise, we're just reinforcing the same mindset. And I think I've seen that, you know, in a lot of activist spaces, you know, it's often like white males who have most speaking time, or white women after that. And like what you said with XR, you know, like who's promoting everyone getting arrested, and then who actually can get arrested as a way of civil disobedience. Like, unless we have that social inclusion, you know, like we won't actually be able to have a movement that touches everyone. And when we flip that coin, it also means that the more people who can participate in our movements, and the more people that are actively involved, it also means the more solutions open up. And like, surely that's the goal of our movement, right? To win, like,
find solutions.
Yeah, like the more solutions and the more voices and the more ideas we have, the more way we can actually fight for change. And like, yeah, and I feel like that should be the point of our movement.
Yeah, it is. It's totally, it seems like the missing link is that one that you've mentioned in a few ways, is that it's really about, it's, I'm trying to think how best to describe this. It's kind of about, it's obviously, it's not even just about amplifying other voices. It's like letting the people who are affected by it, and like you've said, are dealing with it, who are already experiencing or have experienced like apocalypses, like living apocalypses of their cultures and communities, and saying, you know best what to do here. So we're going to support you to do that. I feel like it's always, or there's that, and if we talk about like NGOs and charities and stuff, it's like even worse, right? Because then it's, there's the whole kind of nonprofit industrial complex involved, where we'll send you some leaders to guide you, to help you through this. But it's like, well, it's kind of, we Westerners created this problem in the first place. So actually what would really help is us
just
stepping back and providing whatever other support we can give that doesn't mean we're leading it, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, there's almost like a colonial superego involved somewhere.
For sure. Yeah. Like that way of like saviorism and like, yeah, absolutely. And I think especially in sustainability, there's also something to be said around, especially around, for example, indigenous knowledge of like, we are recognizing, you know, that like you have all of this knowledge and all of these possibly solutions, and we will make room for you to lead the way, but simultaneously we will not put all the labor to you. And there needs to also be some agenda around like, we need to work on not appropriating that knowledge and that on those skills. So like, I think something that some people talk around that is like making room and making over. And that can kind of mean like, there will sometimes be spaces where like, we need to be the voice, because we have, for example, a privilege that allows us that voice, which means we can amplify. But then in other ways, it can mean that we can use our resources to create a space for someone else to lead. And ultimately, you know, like, for example, decolonization is all around actually Indigenous peoples leading the way, and like non-Indigenous peoples not having their fingers in the issue and like following. But that requires justice at the center, because if we are just asking them to do the hard labor and then profiting off that, like that is, you know, again, colonization. So it's actually, yeah. So there needs to be, I guess, like in different circumstances, in a different context, different things are required. And, you know, and that's completely okay. And like that, I think also like that's the beauty, that like, it doesn't mean that the people who right now have different ideas and different things can't ever lead, but it means that like the person that is always leading shouldn't be always leading. Like, you know, everyone has their parts to learn and to teach and to grow and to grow together, I think.
Yeah, it's almost like, I think we can get very wrapped up in like roles and identities and it's maybe this is again where systems thinking kind of comes into help, because in systems things are like changing all the time, but you still get kind of like an overall I don't know, is it like homeostasis or something like that? Yeah. Is that the right word? Like, yeah. So it's kind of like understanding that unpredictability is like normal and okay. Mm-hmm. And as we learn and unlearn, things start to shift, and we need to be kind of adaptable and flexible as activists to know where best to put our focus, you know, something like that.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess also there's something around, like, I think activism, particularly the kind of activism that requires like quick and fixed like solutions, is probably not going to be able to rise to the challenges of the, you know, like century old exploitative system we're trying to fight here. So like being, I guess also as an activist, like learning that like that we need to fight for things beyond our individual lifetime just for the sake that it's the right thing to do is really, really difficult, because we are so trained in this capitalist system that, you know, we need these quick achievements and we need to be able to write and preach to the world what we have achieved. Mm-hmm. And I think deep system change is not that, because you often don't see on paper the achievements you have done. Like, that's more individual change. And I guess that's where like individual and system change meet. And like, there are some things you need as like your, I guess it's like your fuel that keeps you going. But overall, it needs to be beyond your individual heroism and, you know, individual goals. Like, it needs to be beyond, and it needs to be what is good for what's beyond you and for the collective. That's a hard sell for people, for us all, that we have grown up for, like, you need to be able to shout and write on your CV all the things you've done.
But totally. Yeah, that's so right. Yeah, it is. It's like thinking, I suppose one of the problems with combating climate crisis is that we are thinking, if we're trying to think, okay, you know, what I'm doing now will have an impact on things maybe hundreds of years in the future. But then there's obviously that very kind of overwhelming sense that there might not be a future for humans, you know, or any other species on the planet, because it's so bad. I mean, things are so bad that they're almost, it seems like they couldn't get worse. But then, you know, how do you factor that in? I think I want to pick up on that point before maybe we'll go into that, though, that I think it's just so important what you were saying. And I feel this, especially in the animal liberation movement and in my own activism with it, is that we're never really going to see animal liberation, not in this lifetime.
Yeah,
And maybe never, actually, because I'm not sure that that type of exploitation will ever end. And so knowing that, what keeps us going, and knowing that you will never see the results of your activism, or that it might not achieve the things that you think it's going to do. So I'm not sure what my question is there, but I suppose the overarching thing is, with the time constraints that we've kind of been told there are within climate crisis, how do we deal with that in order to be effective with such an uncertain future?
I mean, I guess in a way, yeah, it's really difficult when you think that a lot of the things you're fighting for, you won't, you know, be able to achieve and see in your own lifetime or ever. But I think with the climate crisis, it's so important that we recognize that people are already suffering from this. And it's not something that is like that, you know, like that's been sold to us, like it's doomsday in X amount of years. People in the UK are suffering, people are suffering in other parts of the world, and it's people who have been most excluded from having the resources to actually be able to deal with that. And it's people who are also often, you know, their livelihoods sustain my privilege. And I think in a way, for people living in the UK, that is so uncomfortable to recognize that people who are already suffering under the climate crisis sustain us right now. And we only care about the climate crisis here because now we realize it might actually affect us. And I think in many ways, the pandemic has really shown that, like, has shown this, like, wait, a lockdown could actually happen to me. I thought that only happened, you know, to that. Or like suddenly these like privileges that we have taken so for granted are kind of exposed. I mean, I hope that radicalizes lots of different people, because I'm not sure like how bad does it have to get. And I think that's why at this point, like, I'm whatever gets people to act or like to get active, whether that's like their individual concerns around their like children, you know, like thinking about children, or their, I don't know, their loved ones. Like I'm sad that it took you a personal experience to think about also like other people. But if that's what it takes, then like, you know, please like join. And then, and then that's where like justice again needs to be centered beyond your individual livelihoods. But so I guess in a way, like, the climate crisis is now so urgent because the science is so clear. But also, I suppose some scientists, you know, say already it's completely lost. But I'm not sure that hopelessness is something, or like granting other people despair is something useful. And I think for me, I've come to accept that, like, that hope is like, you know, an action that we have to do because it's right and because we believe that another world is possible and other futures are possible. And, you know, like, I guess, that's where like also my hope comes into like grassroots activism and like community projects, because I have so little faith at the moment that like big scale and radical change for climate change will come from the top, because there's so much profitable, there's so much profits and non-action that when I look into the communities and like what people are doing, even though that's not going to address everything. I think also like we need to upscale and out, like scale that out as much as we can. And that's, I probably sound a lot more hopeful than I actually am sometimes, but also, you know, people give me hope. Like, I don't know. I feel like hopelessness is a privilege, because people that are already suffering under the climate crisis, they are fighting for their lives. So how can I sit here and like not do anything because it's hopeless? And that's not to romanticize, like, you know, the struggles or anything that other people are facing. But I think it's like this wake up call that we should have had for decades, but like that many of us are having now. And it's like, well, we can't have hopelessness when people are already suffering and being violated.
Picking up on the things you've said around, you know, how for many people in the world, they're already affected by climate change and have been for a long time. We've seen it. I mean, we're seeing it now. Well, we've seen it for the last few years as well, but it's happening again in Europe, in the UK, with refugees coming over in boats and horrible things being done to them by coast guards and the military and stuff like that. And then obviously the camps are horrendous conditions and so on. But it couldn't be any clearer that climate change is playing such a huge part in that, in making people, you know, head over towards Europe to try and find some kind of better life. And obviously there's been wars and all that kind of stuff, which often the West has provoked or started or is funding and so on. But what do you think? It seems to me like the issue around refugees in the UK is almost it's in the news because it has to make the news, because they can't ignore it as much as mm-hmm. the mainstream media would like to. And when it's presented, obviously, it's presented very badly and not as it should be. I suppose my question is, it feels like that's being swept under the carpet as well, even though it's mm-hmm. also like a driver for the right or people that are right-leaning to like say, oh, you know, shut the borders and all that kind of stuff. That's just going to get worse.
Yeah.
What can we do, I suppose, to alleviate that situation? If it feels kind of like me as an individual in the UK, my lifestyle changes might help a little bit at some point, but is there anything else we can do collectively?
I think the thing around like climate refugees is that it's not going to get better. Like, you know, climate change is like a form of violence that almost exacerbates everything else. So like when we imagine like wars and already like dire food supply and all of these things, like climate change makes that worse and more unpredictable. So in a way, when we think about more just futures, then like stopping climate change beyond just like what climate change is and does, it is also a way that like we prevent, you know, further wars and further famines and further violence. I guess like that's one aspect of like, you know, we need our governments here because we are such big polluters in this world and we do profit off climate change right now. When we are looking at like, you know, like how, for example, like refugees are coming over, first of all, I think they have every right to, but also when we think about how do we prevent like the necessity of like fleeing homes rather than like that being a choice, then like tackling climate change would be a prevention strategy, which it's never talked about. And already in the UK, there are climate refugees. Like there's a town in Wales, which are the first UK refugees. And obviously they have a lot more stability in the UK because they are protected by the government because they're UK citizens, which again just shows like how, you know, our ideologies around nationalities and borders can like, I guess, like reinforce these forms of violence forms of violence that prevent adaptation to the climate crisis and like deny safety to those most in need.
Mm-hmm.
I guess when we think about like the individual things we can do in that case, like beyond trying to reduce our own ecological footprint, which I guess we can do, like, and we should do if we are big like emitters, and we are usually when we live in the West and in like middle upper classes. But I guess it's also like a way of like advocating and like lobbying our governments, lobbying the systems that are profiting of exploitation, exploitation like internationally from like refugees, challenging narratives around ecofascism that say that overpopulation is the cause of climate crisis, because it's definitely not.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I guess standing up to fascism as individuals and challenging the xenophobia that comes, you know, in the fascism that is against refugees, and like thinking of like why shouldn't these people have a safe home, I think is like something that like we need to challenge like every single day, and like challenge the newspaper, even the way that they report on it, you know, because
talking about eco-fascism, there's been some more coverage of it in recent years, or maybe it's just me paying more attention to it, I don't know. But do you think it is on the rise, and like how does that manifest?
I think it's definitely on the rise, and especially this year we definitely saw a lot more of it because of Corona and these narratives around who is valuable and who isn't, and that's disgusting. And I guess like ecofascism it makes excuses around saying that like people are the virus, and certain people are the virus, because ecofascism always stems from racism, and it has a long history of, for example, like seeing like which population groups should or should not have children. There has been historically, and like even in recent decades, been like forced sterilization. This was what exposed like a couple of weeks ago in the concentration camps in the US, where Latinx women are being forced sterilized, and like an eco-fascists, you know, like kind of like pick that up and say that like that would solve the climate crisis. Way it's like just covering up the toxic systems and the clearly destructive systems that we have right now, and just blaming people who have least benefited of these systems. I mean, I was definitely taught in my environmental science degree, like this was one of the things that they regularly teach, overpopulation statistics. And like, so I think in many ways, it's super insidious. And like in many ways, it also kind of like holds up the narrative that we talked about earlier around like the like white savior or like the good person of like, I'm not a fascist, but I do think that overpopulation is the problem. You know, but like these people, exactly these people wouldn't question why billionaires exist, or like these people wouldn't question why 100 companies are responsible for 71% of greenhouse gas emissions globally. So there's such a shift of like, let's blame some individuals rather than the actual, you know, the actual contributors to
right. The actual problem is in your face and pretty obvious, but some people are seeing it like, because that's the status quo, you know, and they're part of it. And I think it's because so many people obviously think that, you know, we've been sold this lie that we're all basically billionaires in waiting. If we just work hard enough, start our own company, grow it, because that's the capitalist mindset, grow your company, get more employees, get more products, sell more stuff, you'll be rich one day. And if you can't be rich that way, what to do is become a social media influencer and like promote stuff on your page and all this kind of stuff. So I think it's really white people not questioning enough the white supremacist system. And it's like eco-fascism like sounds like it's like the obvious thing is like, you know, literal Nazis involved in the environmental movement, which is part of it. But also, like you say, it's that thing about it's these charities and other groups that promote the overpopulation myth that that are obviously they're trying to do a good thing, seemingly. Is that population thing, is it based on just bad science and it's just worked its way into the narrative over time?
I mean, I'm not 100% sure, like this side, I think, you know, a lot of, I mean, the Nazis definitely used like eugenics and, you know, like a lot of it comes from that. And when in New Zealand, the Christchurch shooting, he was an eco-fascist, like his motives for the shooting were that he thinks overpopulation is related to the climate crisis. And that was his motives for some of his, like some of his motives for the shooting, you know, and like, that was never a narrative that I was told at that time when it happened. But now looking back and like kind of like researching the roots of like ecofascism, you know, that popped up. And I was like, wow, like we so easily sweep under the carpet what's really out there. And, you know, like even that now in a global pandemic, we say that there might be a silver lining because like there's less flights or something. There are never silver linings when there's suffering and violence and death involved for anything.
I've heard you speak and post before about futurism, and we need imagination to be able to allow ourselves to find that hope that's going to generate and create these new worlds that we want to see. So what can you say about that?
I think when we think about all the things that we don't want, it's also super important that we think about what we do want. And, you know, like while we are deconstructing or dismantling some of the things that we are up against, we also need to be thinking about what comes instead. So that can be as small and as big and as outrageous as it can be. Like for me, I was never like growing up, I was never taught to be like super outrageous. And even now, often when I, you know, talk to people about, you know, like, what if we didn't live in a capitalist system, like that always gets met with, oh, you're naive and, you know, blah, 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 blah. But, and you won't live in that utopia. First of all, I think it's super important for our own mental well-being to know that there are alternatives and it doesn't have to be this way. And also it means that we are growing new values around actually what could be instead. So like while we are dismantling things, we are growing new things, and like these things will be based on justice, and these will be based on like equity. So Futurism is kind of this like field that practices that, like actively practicing imagination. And for me, I would also say imagination beyond your own self. So thinking about like the best possible, I don't know, morning in 2050 for your community or something, and like making that a regular practice also in like our movement spaces and our friend spaces, like because when we actually know what we as a collective would like to see, we can also start to see a little bit more clearly some of the things we need to be doing in order to get there. And personally, I keep on thinking around like, why is it so outrageous that I believe that there should be a world without wars, or that there should be a world where everyone has safe food from their community, like to the community food, or like that like water isn't polluted. Like that's actually not an outrageous thing to imagine. For me, that should be the bare minimum. But the way I think that we are taught to kind of like, you know, leave our imagination in our childhood is because imagination is so powerful and it makes us see what is actually possible when we really start to see and to train ourselves as a collective to go beyond the status quo and don't accept what the status quo gives us, which is less than crumbs.
Yeah, true. Yeah, that's quite powerful, actually, because humans are always telling stories to each other. We're making films, writing novels, poetry, singing. You know, that creativity and that artistic stuff has kind of been, I mean, I've just always felt like since a teenager, in man, it must have been the conditioning that you leave that stuff. That's like your bit of fun time that you can have once you've done all the work.
Yeah.
And you have to work to earn the time to do that creative stuff. And some people are lucky enough, it depends what way you look at it, whether they're lucky or not, but some people say maybe work in the creative industries and say, I love my job. I do this thing I'm passionate about. But then obviously when the money gets involved, it can kind of, you know, it can kind of ruin it as well. But I like how you say, you know, we need to be able to have this collective imagination within our movement spaces, because how often are we sitting down and telling stories to each other about how we want things to be and what could be. I'm just thinking particularly about animal liberation movement. We spend so much time sharing like horrific videos of like tortured animals and talking about how, how much like cruelty there is and the practicalities of, you know, how are we going to do this action or how are we going to battle this company or whatever, that there isn't the kind of the only positivity comes about sometimes when you see like, you know, some sanctuary footage in an animal that's finally, you know, been liberated. But even that in itself is just like, that's a rare instance.
Yeah.
So we're not telling each other the stories of what could be, what the future could look like for all of us. So that thing about collective imagination is really powerful.
Yeah, and I think also, like, it's so easy to imagine dystopian futures because a lot of it is obviously around us and it would be maybe scaled up or even worse. But also, like, positive futures, like, for us to, like, have these thoughts, it means, like, it's possible. And I think that's, like, super uplifting. And also, you know, is it actually, I think there's like something like futurism can obviously be dystopian and utopian, but also realizing that there will not be just one future and realizing that like the endless possibilities of outcomes. And that again shows that like grassroots movement and community is incredibly important. And what you were just saying about, you know, also like the videos, for example, about like liberated animals that we occasionally see, how are we learning from those stories? And how are we also learning from these other beings? Because a lot of, I mean, a lot of animals live in community, and a lot of animals like actually would have, like would be able to teach us so much, especially when we think about, you know, like interspecies like relations and like, you know, living in different ways that are beyond what like our society has told us. And I think futurism kind of encompasses that we can go beyond our like individual self and, you know, imagine what would be, you know, a positive futures for a community beyond human animals only. That seems like a little bit outrageous because we are not trained to do that, but like, you know, it's just a fun activity to do, but also it's a super powerful like catalyzing change. Like that's what it is to me. Thank you.